Okay, morning everyone. Thanks to you all very much for coming to the latest in the school's knowledge transfer seminar series. This time the talk's being given by Keith Campbell. Keith's had a long distinguished scientific career. He started originally as a medical lab technician, from which he did a BSc in microbiology. He then followed that up with his doctorate and Marie Curie Research Scholarship at Sussex, and then eventually moved to Scotland in the Roslin Institute in 1991. It was there, of course, that he did what is easily his most famous piece of work. You can see her up there. He cloned Dolly. So he came here as a professor in 1999. I'm very pleased to have him. And I'm going to hand over now and let him talk to you about some of what he's been doing. Thank you.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to see everyone here. I can't go on this side, I've got to stay this side. What I want to talk to you about this morning is some of the reasons and the history of why we cloned Dolly and some of the things that have been done since Dolly was cloned and what cloning is for. Not a lot of heavy science. For the scientists in the audience, there's another lecture coming up soon which will be a lot more scientific. So it's now 15 years since we cloned Dolly, and so time flies. During that time, a lot of other species have been cloned. So I'm going to try and go through some of the reasons to start with. In order to show you what cloning is about and why some of the reasons behind cloning Dolly, I just need to have a short introduction on early development. Now, we all start life as a single cell. The unfertilized egg is then fertilized by the male sperm. So we get this egg then becomes what we call a zygote. And it contains DNA from both your mother and your father. And that combines in the nucleus. And as we go through development, as we divide into 2 cells, 4 cells, 8 cells, etc., each of those cells contains 2 copies of the DNA, which are equivalent to that from your mother and your father. Now, as we go through development, various things happen. And this DNA that's in these nuclei has to control the events that happen, and we end up with all the organs, etc. But I'll come to that in a minute. So this is a cartoon version of a fertilization, cleavage to 2 cells, 4 cells, etc. And these are some pictures. Now, to put this in perspective, this is actually a mouse egg here, but that would fit on the point of a pin. I mean, they're tiny, they're about 120 microns, so about a tenth of a millimetre in size. So we all start life pretty small, actually. And this is actually a human embryo here. This is after about 2 days, it's about 8 cells. This is a human embryo as well. And this is a sheep embryo, which is actually hatching out. And you can see the egg, or in this case the zygote, is enclosed in a sort of halo, a sort of cover, a jelly cover. It's a bit like a frog egg. It's in this protective layer called zona pellucida. And here, this is actually a cloned embryo, and to do the cloning, as I'll show you, we have to actually break a hole into that zona pellucida, and this embryo is hatching out through that hole that we made. But in normal cases, the embryo has to leave this protective covering, depending on species, at different stages, and implant into the uterine wall so that it can form, the placenta can be formed, and you can get the fetus and then develop. Now, one of the major questions that always puzzled developmental biologists was how we go from a single cell through embryo development, fetal development, and we end up as an adult containing all of these different tissues, cell types. So it was a great question for developmental biologists over 100 years ago. People were thinking about this. Firstly, they realized that the zygote must contain all of the instructions, but how did this change as we go through, and how do cells become specialized and fulfill specific functions? I mean, if all of the cells have DNA in it's the same, how does a skin cell know it's a skin cell and a liver cell know it's a liver cell? So one of the fundamental questions of developmental biology is what are mechanisms which control differentiation? Now, the first thing they found out was that the instructions they thought were in the nucleus, and they identified things called chromosomes. Now, we now know that the information is actually made up of DNA, and that was only brought around, discovered, and structure found in the 1950s, but the chromosomes are composed of DNA, which is effectively the code which produces all the instructions for producing all animals. And we know that this DNA can control development, firstly, from the embryonic stage. Now, this is a group of cow embryos in a dish developing during the first 7 days. And the ones which are surrounded by the red rings are the ones which are going on to develop the most. And they will form blastocysts, and then they will hatch out, and that's the stage at which they go off and implant almost into the uterus. So we know that these instructions, the DNA is made into chromosomes, and it controls development from the embryo stage, and then up into the fetal stage, and up until we become adult animals. However, in 1898, didn't know that DNA existed. It was only in the 50s that it was actually demonstrated. So scientists realised that the fertilised egg must contain all of the instructions to form a complete individual. But they came up with different reasons for how cells specialised. And one of those was, as the cells divide, basically it throws away all bits of information it doesn't need. So a liver cell just retains the instructions to be a liver cell, and a skin cell retains instructions to be a skin cell. And so we now know that that's not true, and most of the cells in our body contain complete copies of the genome. However, they suggested that during this early development, genetic material was divided, and so it only contained the genetic determinants required for that function. And so they started to try and do experiments to prove this, or to see whether this was actually true. One of the earliest experiments was done in by a chap called Wilhelm Rue. And if you think back, when there were those two cells, after the egg first divided into two cells, what he did is he took a sea urchin embryo, and in one of the cells he got a needle, heated it up, stuck it into the cell to kill it. And what happened is the side which he'd killed didn't divide, and the side which he hadn't killed carried on to divide. However, this is from his original drawings. This is what he saw, and it was a little bit misleading, as it appeared that he only got half an embryo. And it appeared to support this theory that as cells specialise, they throw away some of the instructions. However, a little while later, instead of actually killing one of these cells at the two-cell stage, another scientist just pulled them apart, effectively, while vigorously shaking them. And what he got were whole embryos that were just a bit smaller. So it appeared that at least in these very early stages of development, two cells in this case, both of the cells had the same developmental potential and contained all of the instructions. And this was repeated with frog blastomeres and also with salamander blastomeres. So, what is the basis of clone? Well, in order to further experiments were done, and a chap called Hans Spemann in 1928 used what in those days was a really useful piece of embryological equipment, which was a piece of baling. It's very fine and very strong. And so what he did is he took effectively this is a salamander egg, it looks like a frog egg, and he tied the baby hair around the egg so that the instructions of the nucleus were stuck in one half of the egg. That half began to divide and cleave into cells. After a little while, he loosened off the baby hair and let a nucleus pass across the bridge and then tightened it up again. And what he got was twins. So effectively, that was the first cloning experiment whereby effectively he transferred a nucleus on a slightly later stage of development into an egg, a half an egg with no nucleus, and got development. Now, Spemann thought about this and thought this is a great way to actually follow the developmental potential of the nucleus in all of the cells of our body. So by taking cells from later and later stages or from different cell types, putting them back into an egg, you can see whether they developed into a whole individual. And he suggested this in 1938. Unfortunately, due to the lack of equipment, and also Spemann became very ill, he was unable to actually do any of these experiments. So nothing really happened for a few years, but he effectively came up with this concept of nuclear transfer, which is a reconstruction of an embryo by transferring the genetic material from a donor cell into an egg from which the genetic material has been removed. Now, it's not as simple as that, and this slide's a bit early, but I need to show you that it's a multi-stage procedure, and we need lots of different things. The first thing is we need some cells. Nowadays, and I'll come to this in a while, we actually can culture these in the dish, but that was not always the case. We need to obtain an egg. Now, I've got a picture here of a sheep, and this is an unfertilized egg. The work we do here, primarily, is with farm animals. We get all our eggs from the slaughterhouse, so they're a byproduct of the fact we all eat sheep, pigs, and cows. We have to remove the genetic material, and then we have to get the nucleus from that cell into our enucleated egg. And we usually do this by fusing the two cells together. We then have to make sure, well, we have to trick this reconstructed egg, effectively, into thinking it's being fertilised. So we can do that by a process called activation. You can do that using various chemicals, or you can give it an electric shock. And the egg thinks it's been fertilised. We can then culture that egg in the laboratory to a stage, and with the animals, we work on sheep and cattle, basically, about 7 days. We have embryos which we consider a good quality, and we can transfer them into a surrogate recipient mother and then wait for gestation, and hopefully at the end get out a nice healthy lamb in this case, or a cow. So gestation in sheep is 147 days, in cattle it's 9 months, in pigs it's 3 months, 3 weeks and 3 days, so you can see there's quite a long wait to see whether your experiment's actually been successful. So this was proposed by Spener back in 1928, but nothing really happened until the early 1950s when two scientists called Briggs and King, working in the USA, started to try and do nuclear transfer using nuclei taken from early frog embryos, and they found that they could actually produce tadpoles. And then John Gurdon, who is a scientist who's still working since his early 70s, works in Cambridge, reported the production of not only tadpoles, but in fact whole adult Xenopuses, the South African pork toad, using nuclei or genetic information taken from an epithelial cell from the intestine of a tadpole. So this was a specialised cell. So this gave us a great inkling back in 1962 that some of this work was potentially possible. However, in further experiments, although he could produce tadpoles, but he could get no adults when he used adult skin cells. Now, back in 1962, we didn't have all the modern molecular tools we have now. So John Gurdon used colour markers to show that he had actually been cloning and it wasn't an artifact. So this is a South African claw toad, the normal pigmented variety, and this is an albino variety. Pink eyes and just white skin. So he used eggs from this and cells or nuclear donors from an albino. And so these are all clones of one frog. Now, frogs, useful. The thing with frogs is the eggs are very big. They're over a millimeter in diameter. They're covered in jelly. You've all seen frog spawn. You can pick them up with a pair of tweezers. Walk around the lab and put them on a bench. They're quite easy to do some work. As I said, mammalian eggs are significantly smaller. They're about 120 microns or a tenth of a millimetre. And so you need significantly more complicated equipment. So here we have some of the equipment in the labs over at the South Lab. And this is just a complicated microscope. It's difficult to see, but on here there are some very sensitive manipulators which allow us to position pipettes and move them very precisely so that we can actually nucleate these eggs. And these is just some equipment for making pipettes, and this is just a machine for actually fusing the cells together. So all in all, this costs quite a lot of money. Now, doing nuclear transfer, if you can play computer games, you can actually do nuclear transfer because it's a lot of hand-eye coordination, effectively, when you're doing it. So just to show you a few pictures of what goes on, this is an oocyte. Now you say, well, how do you get the DNA out of the oocyte when you can't actually see it? Well, here, there's a little lump on the outside of the oocyte. Now, when that oocyte is developing into an unfertilized egg, it has to throw away some of its DNA. It goes through a process of meiosis. And so the DNA it throws away is here, and the DNA that remains will be just inside the oocyte, underneath the polar bodies, we call this piece of DNA that's been thrown away. So we come along here with what looks like a very dangerous procedure. A very sharp pipette will puncture this zone of pollution, and we can aspirate off some cytoplasm. Now, this pipette looks huge, but in fact, it's about 20 microns. So it's tiny. We can then, what we don't want to do is damage this. So we stain the DNA, but we only look at it with ultraviolet light in the portion of cytoplasm that we've aspirated. So here you can see we've removed the chromosomes from this egg. We then take a cell and we put it in contact with our enucleated egg, and then we can actually get those two cells to fuse and transfer the contents, the DNA and all the cytoplasm into the egg. And as I said, we can do that by fusing the two cells together with an electric shock, or people can use chemicals or viruses. In some species, you can actually directly inject the nucleus, but it is much more difficult to do. And let's see if this will work. So just to show you that in a bit more detail, you see this is a very sharp pipette. This is actually a cow egg, and it's being held by suction on this pipette here. And here we can see, you can turn it around here, you can see the polar body at the top there. So we come along with our sharp pipette and we can puncture through this zona pellucida and aspirate off some cytoplasm. Hopefully it contains the DNA that's in here and the polar body. So you'll see two blobs of blue in a second, which are the staining for the DNA to show that it's been aspirated. So that, we see two fluorescent spots. So we've actually removed the genetic material from inside that egg. Right, so as I said, started doing frogs in the 50s, and then John Gurdon was fairly successful in the 60s. But mammals, nuclear transferring mammals, didn't really start till the late 80s. And in the first instance, donor cells were restricted to using nuclei from very early embryos. So people found they could take the nucleus of the cells from an embryo with about 16 to 32 cells and do the nuclear transfer, but the whole procedure was very inefficient. So the first sheep was cloned in 1986 by Steve Williston in Cambridge, using this procedure and using nuclei from embryos which had 8 cells. So when I started working in nuclear transfer in 1991, this was about where things were. We cloned from very, very early embryos. In fact, some of the early work we did was to try and improve the efficiencies, and this is one of the first lambs we cloned up at the Roslin Institute, using blastomeres from early embryos. However, what people wanted to do was to be able to clone, not from early embryos, that's just the way of multiplying the embryos, but to clone from somatic cells. So why did they want to do that? Well, two questions. Firstly, it was Spavin's original experiment. Are the nuclei equivalent? It had been published by a number of people that cloning from a somatic cell would never be possible. But nothing's impossible. However, at the time I worked for the government, and so there were slightly different reasons behind it, and I worked for an agricultural institute, and so they were interested in cloning from adult farm animals for a number of reasons, one of which was genetic modification, but I'll come back to some of the reasons in a minute. So how could we do this? Well, in the first instance, people said, well, cloning from somatic cells is never going to be possible, so you're not going to do it, we're not even going to give you any money to do it, so that's a different story. And so they suggested we had to find a cell type which works. Now, everybody suggested we needed a thing called an embryonic stem cell. So probably everybody's heard of these stem cells in the press. We still have no embryonic stem cells in cattle, sheep or pigs, so it's a good job we didn't wait until we got them, because that's 20 years ago. The other way was to actually study the nuclear transfer procedure and to modify it. Now, that's about a 3-hour lecture, so I won't go into that, but that's effectively what we did. We modified the nuclear transfer procedure. And in July 1995, we produced these are the first two animals we produced. They were called Megan and Moro. You say, well, why is Dolly the most important one? Well, these were all over the press. The paper was published on a Friday. They were in the press on the Friday, the Saturday, the Sunday, and the Monday. But on the Monday, somebody walked into a school in Scotland and shot 15 children. So it very quickly disappeared from the news, because obviously the massacre was significantly more newsworthy. However, we, and a lot of people said it was a fluke, and we'd never be able to do it again. So we actually went back, and also they said that possibly these are females, you'd probably never be able to do it with a male. So we went back and we actually got a male embryo, which we sent, and we made some cells, and we produced these four cloned male lambs. And then we started to do Spayman's experiments. So we moved up, we took out a fetus, which was day 26, made some cells from that, and produced these two black Welsh mountain lambs. Now you may wonder why all these sheep look different. I'll come to that in a minute. And then at the time we were working with a pharmaceutical company who were working with mammary epithelial cells that they'd taken from a six-year-old ewe. So we did the same experiment with those and dolichocorp. Now the reason all the sheep are different colour is, like John Gurdon, we were using different breeds so that we knew a male sheep hadn't jumped into the enclosure and just bred with our female sheep. So we use different breeds to monitor that. I mean, we also do all the molecular biology, but we mainly use the different breeds, so we knew as soon as it was born that it was the correct thing. So Dolly was born in 1996. It wasn't published until 1997. And this is a cover of Nature, the magazine that it was published in. So at this point, everything went mad, basically. The first thing is people accused us of actually having made it up, because other scientists had published that it was never going to be possible. The next thing is some people said, well, if you have done it, it's a very nice cloned lamb, but why does it have five legs, or how has it got one odd leg? So this is what happens when you give photographers a photograph and they try and airbrush a bit out. They obviously thought that leg, which is actually Dolly's surrogate mother, and this is a different breed, this is a Scottish blackface view, belongs not to Dolly. So that's a very strange picture to have on the front cover of Nature. So first of all, we're accused of making it up, and then people said, well, yes, this is very strange. But the biggest question was, why is she called Dolly? Well, she's called Dolly after Dolly Parton, because she was made from mammary epithelial cells. So that seemed to be the biggest thing that was happening in the news at the time. Anyway, since 1996, the same technique, although with some modifications, has been applied to a whole range of species, including cattle, mice, goats, pigs, ferrets, wolves, dogs. And there are different reasons for all of these, some of which I don't agree with, and some of which I do agree with. I mean, for instance, people are cloning deer in order to shoot them, because there's a genetic component of the size of antlers on deer. So in America, they're cloning deer from which have great big antlers, and then set them free so people can shoot them, cut their head off and stick it on their wall. But that's what people do. But there are lots of reasons for cloning, very useful reasons for cloning a lot of these species. And I'll try and go through a few of those. So some of the major objectives are animal production and preservation of the genome, so preserve our genetics. And then there's the second side, which I said earlier, which is genetic modification. So let's just have a few examples. Now, this is Elizabeth. Elizabeth was a very old dairy cow. She lives in New Zealand. And she was past reproductive function. But she used to produce huge amounts of milk. So obviously they'd like to keep those genetics and maybe reproduce Elizabeth. So these are all clones of Elizabeth. Now you might say, they're all black and white, but the black bits and the white bits are in different places. This is because in cattle particularly, the pigment cells, their migration during development is a bit random. But if you actually scan these and measure the black bits and the white bits, they're about the same, all of them. But genetically, they're all identical. Now, that's for agricultural reasons. Another reason is genetic preservation of maybe something that's a little bit strange or maybe of use in the future. Now this is a thing called the Enderby Island cat. Now Enderby Island is a really, well, I've never been there, I don't think I want to go there. It's an island off the South Island of New Zealand. And there was no one living there, so some Victorian farmers thought, oh, free land, we'll have a dairy farm there. But it rains 364 days a year on Enderby Island, I think, or maybe even 365. So after about a year, they'd had enough of it raining, so they just left the cows there. And they actually, they were just abandoned. And they underwent 20 generations of inbreeding. And their diet changed and their phenotype changed. They got shorter legs. They started living on seaweed, effectively, and living on the beach. Now, New Zealand's very green. And it's a bit like we're killing all the hedgehogs that have gone out to the islands in Scotland. They decided these cows were not normal and they were destroying the natural habitat on this this island. So they went in, the army went in and killed them all. But they, first of all, they collected some semen from 10 bulls and they saved one female. And she was 7 years of age. And they tried to actually breed her for 6 years, but they never got anywhere. After 6 years, they decided to do sort of assisted reproduction, as we do with humans. So they collected some eggs from her, and they were able and did IVF in a dish to test tube cattle, and they were able to produce a single bull calf. At the same time they were collecting those oocytes, they had some cells collected, and they did some cloning, and they produced one clone of this animal here. I can't remember all that animal's name is. So at least they're able to preserve the genetics, because interestingly, they'd undergone a range of changes. Then, other examples, is some, for instance, these cats here, they're reproductively past their age. And secondly, there's another population in another zoo in America, which they've all got a disease. So they clone them, so that brings wild cats back into reproduction so they can actually start reproducing again normally. And the ones with the disease, if they can, obviously with a viral disease, it's in a lot of the cells, but it's not in all of them. So they can take cells which don't have the virus in and then clone and produce disease-free animals. Another thing for genetic preservation is horses. And you say, why horses? Well, most male horses aren't able to breed because in order to make them a bit better behaved, they geld them. So they've removed their ability to reproduce. So then when you get this champion horse that you put out to stud, you can't because it can't reproduce. But if you clone them, the genetics are going to be the same. So there's a couple of race horses that have now been cloned. Although the Jockey Club is very careful about what they allow done because basically it's money and not anything else. But in the States, a lot of people are cloning quarter horses. Other examples are some rare species. This thing here is a mouflon. Now a mouflon is a sort of sheep. We think it's the forerunner to certain domestic sheep. And there are wild populations. This, well, not this one, the one that this was cloned from, was found dead in Sardinia. And my friend, who I showed you a picture of earlier, was working in Sardinia, so someone dragged this dead mouflon into him. He said, here, I've got a dead mouflon, very rare. So he cloned it using an egg from a sheep. Now, you do need an egg from a very, very closely related species, or the same species, for cloning to work. And this is actually a galla, which was cloned using cattle eggs, and this, you know, grows up to look like this if it survives. You've heard a lot of things about animals. People claim cats and dogs. I mean, there are various reasons, you know, get your favourite pet, but is it going to be the favourite pet? And is it going to even look like it? This is the first cat that was cloned, CC, and as you can see, they're different colours. And this is because of the way that cats develop and how the genes are activated during development, which control coat color. But there are suggestions that rather than trying to find lots of dogs that are good for working dogs and blind epilepsy or dogs, sniffer dogs and things like this, if you could actually breed them, you could produce a better dog by cloning. But as I say, you know, you only get an animal, you don't get the memory, or you won't do the same tricks or anything like this, so you're not getting the same animal. Now, as I said, the other reason was to do genetic modification. So what do we mean by genetic modification? We want to change the animal so that it's stable, but we want to put the genetic change in that can be passed on to its offspring. We might want to add a gene, and generally from the same species, or remove a gene, or to modify something so that, I'll come up with some examples in a minute, so that we can change the phenotype or some characteristic of the animal. Now, the thing about cloning is, and I'm not going to go into this, because we can culture millions and millions of cells in a dish, we can do that genetic modification on the cells, select the cell that's got the modification, and then do the nuclear transfer. So why is this beneficial? Well, firstly, we had ways of making animals transgenic, but it was very inefficient. So you'd get in sheep, you get about 5% of them might come out as being transgenic. But the other thing was then you'd have to breed those, and not all of them, the transgene may not be in the germ cells. Whereas if you did nuclear transfer with your selected cells, all of the animals you produce would be transgenic. And every cell in that animal would be transgenic. So therefore it would pass on that genetic modification to its offspring. So if you want to produce a flock of sheep or a herd of cattle by the two techniques we have, microinjection and then breeding, selection and breeding, or by nuclear transfer, you can see there's a significant saving in the time made to produce a flock of sheep or a herd of cattle, which may be genetically modified and producing something that we want. So what do we want by genetic modification? Biopharmaceuticals, which is the production of human proteins for treating diseases. Nutraceuticals is a term given to modified animal products which may be healthier, like low-fat milk. Xenotransplantation, which is the potential for using animal organs for transplantation to humans, to alter some of the production traits in animals so they might grow faster or have less fat in them. To make animals resistant to disease, which would be very useful for farmers and would be beneficial for the animal. So if the farmer doesn't have to spend a lot of money on drugs to treat the animal's not feeling sick. And also, it's beneficial to the rest of the community, because one of the reasons we end up getting lots of diseases which are resistant to antibiotics is because we give so many of them to animals and use them to. And another way is to model human diseases. A lot of research is done by modelling human disease in animals such as the mouse. However, for a lot of human diseases, the symptoms you see in the mouse are not the same as you would see in a human. So they're not very good models, and also they're very small. So if we could have sheep or pigs, they may make better models to develop new technology. So pharmaceuticals, I'll give you a few examples. So the idea is we take a gene that's from normal genes. So what are we thinking of? People with haemophilia, for instance, missing clotting factor. The only way we have of getting a clotting factor is to go to another human being and effectively take their blood out and purify out the clotting factor. Now that's fraught with a number of problems. Firstly, people don't like giving their blood away very much. And secondly, there's a lot of disease-related problems. I mean, there's a cohort of haemophiliacs in Edinburgh who all have HIV from one lot of infected blood. However, if we could take that gene and we could put it into a sheep such that, or a cow or even a rabbit, such that it produces that product or that protein in their milk or in a urine or plasma or semen, one of their fluids, we can then purify that product out, and it's A, we don't need to have human blood, and B, hopefully it won't have any diseases. Now, I worked for PPR Therapeutics for a long time, and obviously this all has to go through the FDA, through lots of regulations, and everybody's going, well, if you do that, what about getting mad cow disease? So experiments were done where they've been lots of experiments, and there's no way that anything could get through this process, so what you got out at the end was completely pure. Unfortunately, due to stock markets and things, PPR Therapeutics doesn't exist anymore. And so a lot of the products that were being made have gone. And so there is one product from America now made by transgenic animals, which is available for medication, and it's an antithrombin. But there are all sorts of things being made. I mean, another one that was made, well, not by pharmaceuticals, was spider silk. People were making spider silk in goat's milk. Now, spider silk is like 10 times as strong as steel. And so they were going to make seat belts and all sorts with this. But the problem is they then have to make an artificial spinneret to make it into the cords. And that's more difficult than making the spider silk. So a few examples. As I said, factor 9 for haemophiliacs. Alpha-1 antitrypsin was treated as elastase. It's for people with cystic fibrosis. It's thought this would treat cystic fibrosis. Fibrinogen is like it's what you get when you cut yourself and you get a clot. So this was going to be used for effectively to send off with the army. So all people in trauma with big cuts, you could inject this in and start the clotting process much quicker and the healing process. There are milk proteins for nutritional, so changing things that are the nutritional value. Antibodies, I'll come back to in a minute. So there were lots and lots, and there are lots more examples of things that can be produced in the milk or the other bodily fluids of farm animals. So can any of this be done? Yes, well, we went on and did quite a lot. In 1997, we produced the first clone transgenic lamb. This is Polly. She produced human clotting factor. As I said, you can make small flocks almost instantly. So this is, they're all clones of Polly. They all have names. Most of the sheep get names. And they all get friends. These are two lambs which produced an enzyme called the extracellular superoxide dismutase. At one point, we thought that might be useful for treating for various bowel disorders, but probably not. But it would be useful for actually transporting organs for transplantation between hospitals, because it stops oxygen radicals damaging the tissue in the organ. This little lamb here produces a thing called calcitonin, which is a peptide which hopefully prevents calcium loss from bones. So it's by drinking milk, or you could actually produce milk, which should help prevent people getting osteoporosis. This is Annie. She was produced at the USDA, which is the American equivalent of MAP or DEFRA as it is now. And she was resistant to mastitis from staphylococcus. So they made her, she's transgenic for a bacterial peptide, but she's completely resistant to mastitis, which is very good for her and very good for the farmer. But going on a bit more, I said we could actually remove genes. Now these are just two examples. These are just to demonstrate that you could take a gene out of sheep. And this one here has the PRP gene, or the prion gene, removed. This was for research. The prion gene is the mad cow disease. So this was to produce some models for research to look at whether these animals could go on and get disease. So as I said, removing some genes for various reasons for research. A lot of people are allergic to various parts of cow's milk, so you can remove some of the proteins to make them less allergenic. So by modifying surface antigens of various species, we may be able to use, and the idea is pig organs, particularly hearts for transplantation, to remove the bovine serum albumin and replace it with a human one, so we can produce vast quantities of human serum albumin for treating burn diseases. And the last one here, which has actually now been done and is working, is to remove the bovine immunoglobulin locus and replace it with the human one, so that you get cows which produce human antibodies. But why would we want to do that? Well, people are very interested in this because of germ warfare, because if we were to have a viral attack on us, we'd all be dead by the time we mounted a response to it. However, or if they could actually give the same disease to the cow, or at least expose the cow to that, to the antigen, then the cow would produce a lot of serum with antibodies in, which could be then used to treat people with the disease. As I said, the whole idea with the xenotransplantation is to maybe use organs from a pig, because especially the pig organs are very similar to human organs. But they would, well, they are, if you transplant them to humans, which has been done in the past, years and years ago, our immune system immediately recognises them and kills them off, effectively. But by changing them, by genetically modifying them, so they wouldn't be recognised as being foreign, we may be able to use pig hearts for transplantation to humans. And so the idea would be you grow some pig cells and you do your genetic modifications, remove genes, and then you go to a nuclear transplant and produce a pig which has been modified. I mean, several people have made comments that maybe the pig will come looking for you later on, because you know, it works both ways, so he might want a transplant. But there are lots of other applications for studying diseases, as I said, studying normal development, aging, studying differentiation, which is what the technique was originally proposed for. And then reproduction, agriculture, genetic preservation, and for stem cells, working with stem cells. However, It's not a very efficient technique, and I'm not going to go through that. At the moment, we're running actually significantly better. We're up to about 20% development. And so just using in vitro fertilization is only about 40%. So it's pretty good, and we've got rid of most of the abnormalities that we see in the early days. In fact, the only animals we've produced have not had any abnormalities. However, of course, you know, in the first came there, there were people claiming we were making new species up at Roslyn, or we were getting giant livestock, you know, we were going to produce cows that could grow as big as elephants, but it's all a bit of a... And this was the best one, I like this one. All the cloned animals are bloodthirsty. And so Dolly clones, she kills the lamb, eats it, and also attacks people. But this was a well-known American high-class publication. However, I will finish there, and this is Dolly's born again. These animals actually live in a field somewhere here, and they're all Dolly's. And they're now 4 years old, and they're perfectly normal and healthy. So I'll finish there, and I'll happily try and answer any questions anyone may have.
Okay. Thanks, Keith. I'll kick off with a question. Did Dolly Parton ever come to Roslyn to meet Dolly the sheep?
No, but she's very, very happy that Dolly was named after. She was not upset. That's what people suggested, but it's not actually true. A lot of experiments have been done now, and the telomere length is reset during the cloning, well, during development, fairly early on in the developmental process. And so the telomeres of newly born animals are longer than the cells they were taken from, so they're reset back to normal. I mean, a lot of people think Dolly died at six because she prematurely aged. She actually had viral lung cancer, so she died of a disease that she caught. It's prevalent in sheep, it's a retroviral disease which is in their lungs, and so they produce a lot of mucus, and if they're sharing water, the mucus goes into the water, the next sheep comes along and eats it, drinks it, and gets the disease, and it's quite prevalent in Scotland. Yeah, well, one of the things that people have suggested is that we can... See, one of the problems is we need an egg from the same species at the moment. So if we haven't got many pandas, we're not likely to get many panda eggs. And we also need a surrogate mother of a very closely related species. Now, it's possible with some of the cats that may be closely related enough to use some domestic cat eggs. But they're all sterile, this is the thing. So it may be that horses, donkeys and things, you can breed together, but most of the combinations are, you know, zebronkies, zebrorses, and hinnies, and all of those things, but most of them are sterile. That's slightly different, but... So people have been trying, they've been trying in China to make panda embryos using cow eggs. And so people have been trying that, and we've done quite a lot of that, because it was also suggested, which I haven't gone into, that this could be used because of we know that the genome is completely reprogrammed. We get a functional animal. We get embryonic stem cells very early in development. So one suggestion has been a thing called therapeutic cloning, that we can make individual embryos for individual people to make stem cells, which are of your own, so that if you then get them transplanted to you, they wouldn't be rejected. And so there's a lot of interest in trying to develop the technique using eggs from other species. But unfortunately, at the moment, I know of no real success in that area. But who knows what will happen in the future.
Yeah. infectious disease, the whole person would flock with infectious disease? Or does the immune system differentiate the environment?
They're all different. Although they're genetically all identical, they respond, they're individual units. So if one catches the disease, they don't all catch the same thing. But, well, the chances are the same as any other flock of sheep.
Okay, there's any more questions?
I mean, one of the big problems we have is that, firstly, there's an organisation called Compassion in World Farming, which is campaigning very hard to get a 5-year moratorium on cloning farm animals for agricultural purposes. And so that's just cloning, never mind genetic modification. So a lot of countries have got very strong feelings against genetic modification. So a lot of the work is actually going on in Pacific countries, in China, one should say. I mean, there are lots of applications that they've got cattle in China that are making got lactoferrin and human lysosome in milk, so to make health milk for make it healthier for people to drink. They've got pigs in China, which are actually made in Canada, but they wouldn't let them be produced in Canada, which actually are transgenic, so they don't produce such a large amount of phosphorus and pollution in their excrement. Most of the work is actually going on in other countries. There's a lot of work going on in Korea and China for xenotransplantation. So we'll just end up having, although we developed it here, we'll end up paying for it when it comes back.
Anyone else? No? Okay, well, thank you very much. Really interesting talk. Good. Keep around.